Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to take a look at home renovation and repair today with our guest, John Freiberger. Back with us once again, registered home inspector. He has more than 45 years of experience. And he specializes in a lot of things, but energy design and restoring older homes are high on his list. So we'll zero in a bit on insulating your attic, maybe sealing your basement, and of course, take your other questions as well as we move along. You can join us at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. John Freiberger, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
I'm very happy to be here, Larry.
Sort of top to bottom here. If we get the from the roof or ceiling to the basement, let's start at the bottom.
All right.
Maybe what can you tell us about wraps for basement foundations?
You're talking about exterior wraps, I think, mm-hmm. because
yeah.
Well, we do have a code standard for basement insulation, and if we have an older house, we're probably not going to meet that highest standard. The problem that we always have with wrapping basements is that the cheap thing to use is plain old foam, and you want to use EPS foam, not XPS foam. Extruded foam is denser and has 20% more R value than the old beadboard sort of foam.
Okay.
Now, what a lot of builders do when they build a house is they put that foam on and they use like a cement slurry to go over the top of it. Not terribly attractive. You hit it with a lawnmower, and pretty soon your foam is getting damaged. So whether you have a newer house where you have foam on the exterior or an old house where you want to add it, there are a couple of products on the that are available, builder supply, that come as basically a single piece. It is a flexible foam, usually extruded poly, with either a rubberized cover or a metal cover.
Okay.
So it goes on all at one piece. One of our old public radio sponsors was Kurt Building Systems, and they have something now called Tech Wrap, which has basically sort of a rubberized system. So you can put on as much foam as you want, depending upon how far your framing is built out above the foundation, or if you want to build some sort of decorative thing to shed water. And then when you put this on, it comes in heights up to 18 inches. You are putting on the foam and protecting the foam all in one thing. And I know that Tech Wrap offers a 10-year guarantee. Nudo system, N-U-D-O, is another one to look at. And theirs, if I recall correctly, is a flexible metal. And I've never tested the two against each other. So
sure.
As far as I know, one is as good as the other. But it's a nice one-step way of helping to add some insulation value. Now, I believe that both of these systems have applied to be an air barrier as well. And air leakage, as you've heard me say time and time again, is one of the major problems we have with our older homes. And as far as air leakage, an older home to me is about 2005, going back to 1600, because technology has really changed in the last 15, 20 years.
So is this, doesn't sound like there are any drawbacks to these products.
Well, there are if you have a stone foundation.
Oh.
And stone is always an issue. And you've heard me talk, I think, about nogging. So you get old houses like mine, 1860. So they built up the stone foundation, and then they put the joists on top of it, and then they infilled between each joist with more stone. So the stone foundation doesn't stop at the bottom of the joist. It stops at the top of the joist. Now, if we make that vapor tight, where's the water vapor going to go?
Yeah.
Because the heat in the basement usually drives the water vapor to the exterior. But if we put on Nudo or Tech Wrap, which is going to be water vapor impermeable, we are going to end up with decay in the tails. So when you get to stone houses, you really need to talk to somebody who knows a good bit, either a very well-educated insulation contractor or, as I always say, if in doubt, have a home inspector come and take a look at it. I mean, interview them first, make sure they know old houses. But there are several people in the state, like myself, that know old houses and can actually give you good advice.
Well, let's go to the top, top of the house. What do we need to do before we might add insulation to our attics?
Well, sometimes before we add insulation, we have to take the existing insulation out. And the problem is we have had vapor barriers, which sort of act like an air seal, since June of 1980 when the Uniform Dwelling Code came into effect. The problem is they all have holes in them. And what we have found, if we take an average of all the houses, you know, from 1860 to 2020, 40% of the heat loss is due to air loss. So if you have a lot of air wicking up into your attic, then you are going to have a problem. Now, it's really easy to tell if you've got a problem, because you just peek your head into the attic, take a look at the nails that are coming through your roof sheathing. If you have dark spots around those nails, that is staining due to condensation. Or on a really cold day, you know, if it's below zero, peek your head up and you may find frost right on the nails. So that then is telling you that you are getting air leakage from the lower part of your house, and of course it's carrying vapor barrier up. So if you find out if you've got condensation, condensation is a sign of air leakage, and that means we need to seal the attic floor. And the easiest way of doing that, well, it isn't real easy in some houses, but the best way of doing it, let's put it that way, is to get rid of the insulation and then use a spray foam of at least 2 inches, because a closed-cell spray foam gives you a complete vapor barrier, plus it gives you R14, and you can put cheap cellulose or whatever over the top of that.
So that's the best. You need to get rid of the other first, though.
That's right, because you can't spray over it.
Okay. John Freiberger, our guest, questions for him. Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. We had some good conditions for ice dams to form last month, John, and maybe you can talk about what causes ice dams.
Well, ice dams are usually a sign that we have some bad insulation. And I took a look at a couple of roofs during the heavy snow. And there were roofs where part of the roof was right down to the shingles, and part of the roof had a foot of snow still on it. And that was telling me that we had some real localized air and thermal loss from the house going up through the roof, melting the snow. And then what happens where we have the snow is that water will run down between the bottom of the snow and the shingles. So it's sort of insulated, right? So it stays liquid. But once it hits the overhang on your house and the gutters, well, it's cold again, so then it freezes. So we have the slow trickle of water coming off the roof, slowly freezing. The gutters get more and more full of ice. The ice starts backing up on the roof, and at some point, there's water behind the ice. And that, if you don't have a roof that has ice and water shield on it, can then leak into the walls or into the interior.
So what's the fix for that?
Well, it's really difficult. The more insulation you have and the less air loss you have into the attic, the less melting of snow you're going to have on the roof. So it really is the money saving on energy that is going to save you the money on the roofing issues. Now, fortunately, the Uniform Dwelling Code requires roofers to put ice and water shield on, which is a self-adhering membrane, and it has to go up to a point that is 2 feet inside the walls. So sometimes, if it's a little narrow overhang, it's a single 3-foot sheet, or it might even be a 6-foot sheet. The nice thing about it is water can back up behind it. When you put the shingle nails on, it seals around the shingle nails, so you can have a big ice dam on your roof, but it is not going to come into your house.
So I've got a neighbor down the street. I walked by the house here. This is just, several days back. But anyway, I was admiring the icicles that were like 6 feet long. I thought, boy, I don't want to be under one of those if it lets go.
Right. And some people have giant icicles and have no other problems. Exactly how the gutters are set often makes a difference as well. And certainly the width of the overhang makes a huge difference.
John Freiberger, our guest. Callers online, I think we should go to the phones. Mark in Rockwell City, Iowa, has something for us. Mark, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I'm looking at finishing my basement out. It's a clay brick foundation. It's about 85 years old. And over the 6 or 7 years we've lived there, there's been little to no water permeation. We don't have a sump pump system, but almost no water comes in. But a little bit, there's been a little of this efflorescence filled up, the lower 2 or 3 feet. And now I don't want to cover that up and insulate, and I certainly don't want to have to dig around the outside of the foundation if I don't have to and coat it from the outside. But would it be advisable or inadvisable to put the EPS foam just over the top 4 or 5 feet of the basement wall and leave the bottom 2 or 3 alone for, I don't know, air movement? So that's just the nature of my question. I don't know if there's any other specifics there that help, but that's what I'm curious about.
Okay. Yeah. Mark, how high is the framing of the house out of above the grade? In other words, how tall is the brick foundation on the exterior?
Yep. So it's the bottom 6 feet is under the ground level. So if you go outside, you still see about 2.5 feet.
2 or 2.5 feet. Okay.
On the outside.
Okay. You get the most bang for your buck insulating higher on the wall, obviously, because once you get a few feet below grade, the earth is still fairly warm.
Yeah.
If you're sort of the same latitude in Madison, as the earth is going to stay between 47 and 50 degrees all year. And sometimes end of summer, it's up to 52 or even 55 degrees. So you may want to think about putting the insulation on the exterior so that that brick is not hidden. Certainly you can do the inside, but it's going to look a little bit funny, isn't it, if we've got an inch or two of foam on that wall. And then remember that that foam then has to be protected, at least in Wisconsin. Now, in Iowa, you're under the International Building Code while we're under the Uniform Dwelling Code. So you'd have to check the IBC to see exactly what you need for a fire barrier. But in Wisconsin, you need a 15-minute fire barrier, which would be drywall or something over it. So how funny is that going to look on the inside? I'm not really sure. And if this is nice-looking clay brick, you know, maybe it's attractive enough to try to do the outside and keep it the way it is on the inside. Does that make sense?
Sure, yeah.
So, so you would use the materials you were talking about earlier in the show, John?
Yes, and could use those materials, or you can also just put the foam on and use a cementous coating.
Mm-hmm.
And homeowners can do that themselves. I think working with the noodle problems or the tech wrap, I think you probably are best having a professional installer put that in.
Mm-hmm. All right. Mark, does that helps?
Yeah, that helps. I think the only other part of that is, considering the inside, would it not be advisable to cover up that insulation, you know, with drywall all the way down? Now, assuming you did that, there would be like an air gap, the lower 2 or 3 feet between the drywall and the cement foundation or the clay brick foundation.
Right, right. There would be. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, because you say you have some efflorescence, you have 85-year-old house, you've got a probably a lime-based mortar rather than Portland. And so obviously we have some moisture coming in, not maybe just water vapor, but that water vapor still is going to form efflorescence. So that way you are going to have at least a little bit of air there between the studs so that you don't end up with a real bad water issue. Be sure to use treated material as your plate. And I really like steel studs for the wall rather than, you know, the plain pine. I'm always worried about things getting... Once you get to 80% humidity, you start growing things.
Yeah.
And that's always a concern. And drywall is really a problem, because the paper on drywall will grow stratibatra and all kinds of things you don't even want to think about. So think very carefully about how you're going to cover these walls.
Good luck, Mark. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. taking a look at home improvement today with John Freiberger of Freiberger and Associates. Tyler Ditter's our engineer today. Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Looking at home renovation and repair today, we've zeroed in a bit on insulation, but taking other questions as well with our guest, John Freiberger of Freiberger and Associates of Fitchburg and Madison. Great to have John back. Linda in Appleton, we'll give you a chance. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hey, good morning. Great program, Larry. I have an older home built in the 1940s. It's a Cape Cod brick. There again, I'm asking about insulation. We've had the attic blown many years ago, but what are your thoughts where they go in and they drill through the mortar of the bricks and then blow in insulation? Because it's an expensive home to heat.
Mm-hmm.
Back in those days, you know, they didn't insulate. You know, it's slab and mortar, and it's probably newspaper in there.
Well, maybe not even newspaper in 1945. Yeah, Cape Cods are the toughest thing in the world. They really are. They really are difficult because on the second floor, you've got these two little attics behind the knee walls, and then you've got that area where the interior plaster or drywall is fastened to the bottom side of the joists, and you just end up with all kinds of problems. The first thing we need to look at, the Cape Cods tend to lose most of their heat upward. I would estimate, without any science behind it, that 85% of your heat loss is air movement and thermal transfer on the second floor. My guess is the walls behind the brick are not your number one problem. Now, what you may want to do is talk to an energy analyst because they will do two things for you. And do this sooner rather than later because the colder it is, the better infrared pictures you get. So the energy analyst can come in with a thermal camera and they can show you exactly what the temperature is of your ceiling, underneath the little attics, the sidewalls on the second floor, the area where the plaster's on the bottom of the joists, and you'll get a really good idea of where the heat is going. And what we have done with some Cape Cods is we have concentrated on the roof, and we basically have sprayed everything we possibly can at the rafter level. So that way, these little attics on the side of the Cape mm-hmm. Cod they're insulated. And if we spray everything, then we are going to have a really good thermal barrier, and we're also going to have a moisture barrier. So we're not going to be having the heat loss, because I would estimate on a Cape Cod that you've probably got 50% of your loss due to heat loss. You may find that once you do that, it doesn't pay to spend a nickel on the downstairs, because now the house is so tight. Because remember, air wants to move upwards. And brick is great because it's hard to blow air through brick. I mean, just try it sometime. So your first floor is probably fairly immune to pressurization, depressurization with wind, but your second floor isn't. But you really need to hire a professional. I think you can go to Focus on Energy and find somebody in Appleton who's got the thermal camera mm-hmm. on. And they can also put a calibrated fan in your front door and depressurize the house to 50 pascals, and then they can go around and show you exactly what's leaking. And I can almost tell you exactly what's going to be leaking, but they can show you with a smoke candle and with a thermal imager. Now, this is going to cost you between $400 and $500, but it might save you from doing $3,000 or $4,000 worth of work on the first floor that isn't worth doing.
Yeah.
And it may make what you do on the second floor actually work.
And so, would there be credits, energy, might there be some money back on this? There used to be. I'm not sure if that's still the case.
Well, Focus on Energy does have rebates in some areas, but not all utilities are part of, and I don't know who is servicing Appleton.
Okay.
But certainly it is worth going to Focus on Energy, number one, see if you're in the rebate area, see what rebates you can get. Number two, find a registered or certified energy analyst.
Yeah. Linda, good luck with that. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. The way to go. Dave in Sturgeon Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, hey, good show, Tom. I really enjoy listening to you. Anyway, my question is that I have a house that we have a bathroom coming into the house from the garage, and we were thinking of possibly putting in a shower stall right off of that going over into the garage. It's a 3x4 shower. We were thinking of doing that for just having it. Problem is that when you're hanging over the garage and you have a garage slab, I would probably have to foot that, wouldn't I?
Do you have because a step have a up into the house from the garage?
Yes, a step up into the house.
Okay, and is it 8 inches or so?
Yeah, it's like 12 inches or better.
Okay, and are the joists running front to back so that they are parallel to the wall that you want to penetrate, or are they perpendicular to the wall you want to penetrate?
They're perpendicular so that you can run the joists right through.
Wonderful.
So you're thinking of maybe cantilever.
Exactly.
Cantilevering underneath.
Yeah. Yeah, your cantilever, generally, you have to have a 2-to-1, but a 3-to-1 is better. So you really need to have designer, architect, engineer, or structural technician tell you exactly what you can do. But if you're going out, let's say 3 feet, you'll probably want to go back 9 feet or go back to a point where there's a good load on top of that joist.
Mm.
So let's say there's a bedroom or a kitchen wall that's coming down, because we're going to get what's called end reaction. You know, you got to think of a cantilever as a teeter-totter, right? So we're going to have a shower out there, which is weight, and we don't want to suddenly end up with an upward bulge in our floor because of positive end reaction. So you're going to have to do a little bit of planning and talk to somebody who knows what they're talking about. And then I think because we're coming into the garage, we're going to want to use spray foam to make the walls as tight as possible. So you should be able to get a spray foam about at least R30 in the shower walls. And then you spray the joists underneath as deep as you can. And you should have almost no heat loss then with that shower.
Yeah.
The question is, of course, is going to be the plumbing that I guess could go into, that should be able to go into that 7.5-inch interstitial space, but you're going to have to be sure that you do a real good job making sure that's completely airtight and well insulated so we don't get a freezing problem.
Yeah. Dave, there you go. Good luck. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's turn to Patrick in Wanakee. Patrick, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, guest. I'm very interested in this program. Back in 1995, we sealed up my house. It's a tri-level, and stone fascia as well as vinyl siding. What I learned is that my contractor put the Tyvek on the inside of the OSB as opposed to the outside of the OSB throughout my house. I am 3/4 of the way of spraying sills all the way around my basement, and because my one bedroom is above the garage, taking care of that garage and basement level sills with total new foam, cleaning up those walls. But I've got Tyvek on the wrong side throughout the rest of my walls. What's the best way of getting that out? I'm basically now taking the old drywall off, going all the way to my stone fascia, and spray foaming the stone to get that seal. But now I'm getting to the point where I'm looking at the rest of the vinyl siding.
Mm-hmm.
What's a good way to approach the top side?
Well, first let me ask you a question. Do you have Tyvek on the outside of the sheathing as well as inside the framing?
No, not that I know of. I haven't gotten to the rest of the walls. What I'm finding throughout it in the basement is that it's on the wrong side. It's inside of the OSB, which mm-hmm. has basically deteriorated to nothing over the last 30 years.
Okay, so we do not have a weather-resistant barrier on the exterior. Wow,
no.
That's really a problem. Having a Tyvek on the inside is no problem at all because Tyvek is breathable. It's porous. But it also means you don't have a vapor barrier on the inside. So we've got a double problem. We have no vapor barrier, and we have no weather-resistant barrier. So you're really looking at some pretty significant work. Now, as we mentioned before, a spray urethane foam is not vapor permeable. So if you have exterior OSB or whatever type of sheathing you got on the outside that's bad, if you take that out and maybe drill a few holes, you should then be able to spray the wall cavities with an isocyanurate type, or I'm sorry, a polytype foam. And that will give you the vapor barrier so that you don't have moisture from inside the house working into the interstitial space and rotting out the new sheathing you're putting on. Then the sheathing that you're putting on, you're going to want to put on either Tyvek, or if you're doing this yourself and it's sort of piecemeal, there are liquid applied vapor barriers. So basically you put up the plywood or the OSB and you take your paint roller out and you paint the wall to make it, to give it a weather-resistant barrier. And you'd have to do a little research online to see exactly which ones there are. The state may have a list also, ones that are certified for use in Wisconsin as a weather-resistant barrier. So it sounds, Patrick, unfortunately, like you've got a heck of a problem up there. Feel free to send me a couple of pictures to my email, and I'd be happy to take a look at them for you and see if I can, you know, give you a little bit more than the sort of sketchy advice I'm giving you right now.
And your email address is?
Very short, FREI at chorus.net. And chorus is spelled like a group of singers, CHORUS, Fry at chorus.net.
All right. Patrick, there you go. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Mary in Shippen, your turn. Hi.
Good morning, Larry and guest. I have a question about my, you were talking about the attic, and I have a 1917 house. We have two furnaces because they had to have one in the attic. They couldn't get through the walls and so on, so I have two. Anyway, I noticed when I was up there that I have, it looks like water came down the nails from the roof or something. There's like little, you can just see little drops.
Mm-hmm.
They're all perfectly round circle drops on the floor and the attic.
Mm-hmm. That's the condensation we were talking about earlier, because with a 1917 house, you probably have a heck of a lot of heat loss going up into that attic. Now, how big an attic is this? Is this a real huge monster attic, or is it more of a manageable size?
It's not managed. It's a huge attic. I mean, it's the size of the whole house.
Hmm. And is it tall? Do you have a steep roof or sort of a shallow roof?
It's a tall.
Oh,
it's
dear.
It's a tall attic, yes.
Oh, dear. Well, Mary, there's a very simple and very effective fix. The problem is it's expensive. And that basically, what you need to do there is to turn the entire attic into warm space, because you've got your furnace, you've got your heat ducts up there anyway, and of course they're losing a lot of heat in the winter. But that may be just too expensive. The second way of doing it is, depending upon what kind of insulation, how much you have in the floors, and whether you've got floors in the attic that have to be pulled up. But as we were talking earlier, of trying to basically get down to the point where you've probably got lath and plaster on the bedroom ceilings below, but get the old insulation out and then do a spray foam spray on that to get both insulation and an air and water barrier. Now, you again, we mentioned earlier talking to an energy analyst, and that might be a good idea for you to do as well.
Yeah.
And then say to them, what is the most efficient way we can put in a thermal barrier, an air barrier, and a humidity barrier all in one? So I think getting a little science behind it, because one way or the other, you have an expensive problem.
Yeah. So.
And again, as Larry said earlier, also check, because you may be in an area where the utility is working with Focus on Energy, so you might be able to get some money as far as a rebate from Focus on Energy for reducing the heat loss from your house.
Yeah. And so go to Focus on Energy, just put in Focus on Energy, and it's going to pop up on your...
Right. Do a search, and then you'll find some people in your local area that are certified energy inspectors.
Yeah. Good luck, Mary. Thank you for calling. Tom in Fitchburg, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I have an issue. We have a basement bedroom. The house was built in the 70s, and it's on a hill. So the north side of the house is all under grade, and the south side of the house, which is the walkout basement, is all walkout. Mm-hmm. The foundation does not wrap all the way around the house. It ends at the wall, and then it begins some sort of a wood frame for mm-hmm. the walkout side of things. Well, we've been in the house for 2 years. It was a flip, and we're finding lots of fun things. mm-hmm. And one of these things is we were seeing ice build up inside of the corner of this basement bedroom. All right. And on the inside of the house.
Mm-hmm.
So there's clearly something crazy going on here. Yeah. So we ripped out the drywall and we found two very interesting things. This is all on the walkout side. Okay. Of this basement room. And, there was a section of the wall that was 1 foot by 2 feet, let's say, that was straight out to the siding. There was no plywood in between any of it. It was basically open to the outside world.
Mm-hmm.
So, yikes. I fabbed up a little frame, put in a piece of plywood, and framed that up so that it's not leaking anymore, put some expandable foam around it, and that was a big portion of that air that we were feeling from the outlet just kind of on that wall that was just coming through. And then I looked at the corner, and the corner is, so you have this concrete wall that is the foundation, and the wood where the framing starts is nailed right up to that vertical end of the concrete foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And when I looked out between those two things, I was seeing light from outside. I was like, well, and that little corner was where the ice that we, this little tiny patch of ice that we were seeing was
sure.
coming. So thinking air was coming through there and finding this way to expand and create ice through this whatever
mm-hmm.
hole that it could find of there, because
mm-hmm.
the foundation has a like a hip wall kind of a thing, and then it goes in for 6 inches or so over the concrete, and then there's wood frame that goes up to the ceiling.
Yeah. So your question is on that then, or?
Yeah. I'm sorry. So that's a long bit of this. Well, when we opened up that lower wall, the insulation was actually better than we were expecting, and we're not sure whether or not we should continue with ripping out insulation and dealing with putting different insulation next to the concrete foundation.
Right.
The vapor barrier, where's the vapor barrier supposed to be? Because when we open up the wall, it's drywall, vapor barrier, fiberglass,
mm-hmm.
Back insulation up that little hip wall. Is that how it's supposed to be?
Yeah, the vapor barrier is to be on the warm side. Problem is with your basement, you have so much air movement, you don't have a warm side, you have a cold side. Now, Tom, if you're getting a lot of air coming into the basement, your house is sucking that air in, and which means that the air pressure in the basement is lower than the air pressure outside. Well, why does that happen? Well, because of air buoyancy, right? That air is going up. It's going up into your attic and then probably being vented out of the attic. So not only do we need to take a look at how to seal and get an air barrier in the basement, but my guess is you've got a profound mess in the attic with a lot of air leakage up there as well. If a person gets an attic completely sealed, you do not get a lot of air buoyancy loss at all. You can still get from wind, because wind can work on the walls, depressurize one side, pressurize the other. So, again, we seem to be repeating ourselves, but I think we probably need to have an energy analyst come take a look at your house, do a blower door test, find out exactly how leaky things are in the basement. You may find that things like the sill boxes have fiberglass insulation in them, but they leak like mad. And you can put 2 feet of fiberglass insulation in a sill box, and it'll still leak. So we really need to depressurize to 50 pascals, use a smoke candle, figure out what's going on, look with a thermal imager. And you should probably, as I said earlier, try to do that while it's cold, because you get better information when there's a big differential across the wall. But this sounds pretty complicated, a little bit on the messy side. So getting a little bit of professional help, I think, is going to save you money in the long run.
Yeah. focus on energy.
Right.
Place to go and find yourself a well, there, all of the people, the workers or the people who do this work are registered and approved by Focus on Energy. So,
yes.
There you go. Tom, good luck. Thank you for calling. JB and Madison, your turn. Hi, JB.
Greetings. I own a 1913 Sears Roebuck kit house. And in the 70s, the previous owners went through, did the drill from the exterior, foamed the inner wall studs, mm-hmm. and or cavities. And subsequently, you know, going on a half a decade later, that foam has totally disintegrated. It is the consistency of cake flour.
Yep.
It has all dropped to the bottom of the cavities.
Mm-hmm.
And one, what does one do now, and how carcinogenic is that?
I'm trying to remember the name of that old foam, because I do remember it being put in the 70s. It'll come back to me eventually, but yes. Well, you put it in the wall, and it immediately shrunk by a third. So the day after, a third of your wall was uninsulated, and then over time, it simply completely fell apart. And, of course, foam is mostly air, which is why it has the insulation value. So once it turns to powder, we have no insulation value at all. So at some point, it'll come back to me as to what that stuff was called, but I do remember it from way back then. So you're probably looking at trying to refoam. It is possible that if they – is this a one-story like a Cape Cod type Sears kit?
It was Bloom Construction. We have sealed the – or filled the areas in between the two stories, so it is no longer Bloom Construction. But, you know, what about removing that, since there is no insulative quality to that cake flour now?
Yeah. Well, there's a little bit because there's some air trap there. But if they are working from the top of each of the wall and each floor, end up drilling two holes, they should be able to vacuum out the majority of that, because you're going to have a hole at the top and a hole at the bottom. You put a vacuum in the bottom, the air is going to come rushing in the top as it comes rushing out of the bottom. You're not going to get every bit of it out, but then again, you don't have to. You just need to get out. If there's a foot of it, that's a problem. If there's 2 inches of it, I wouldn't worry about it.
Hmm. Okay. But then go ahead and...
But then go ahead and refoam. But, and we got to say this to everybody, Larry. Before you commit to foaming the walls of your house, know what's inside. So if we've got a 1913 Sears house, if there's knob and tube wiring that wall, or even old two-wire BX cable, we want to make sure that we have updated the electricals before we put in foam and make it impossible. So I would suggest, JB, unless you know exactly what you've got in those walls, that you may want to hire an electrician to test outlets, take a look at the walls, see if there are any issues, but take care of everything that is in that interstitial space before you fill it with foam.
Yeah, that's very good advice. Good luck, JB. Thank you so much for calling. John Freiberger, our guest today of Freiberger and Associates of Fitchburg. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at home renovation and repair today on the show, Larry Mueller here with my guest, John Freiberger, a registered home inspector in Wisconsin who specializes in evaluating older structures. His firm, Freiberger & Associates, consults in restoring, adapting, and reusing old houses and other buildings. Great to have him with us. Questions, give a call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. A listener emailed to ask, when removing shingles from a roof, how do you remove the ice shield underneath? It always seems to stick like glue to the shingles and roof sheathing.
Good. That's what it's supposed to do. So what I would do is I just leave it. So you can take off the rest of the shingles, probably has felt under it, and then just put a second course of ice and water shield right over that one. So what you're going to have is double protection from the nail penetrations, because remember, ice and water shield is supposed to stick to the nail so that we don't, when we put a nail in it, we don't have a nail hole, because the hole is immediately filled. So I would just go ahead. It isn't all that thick. It's not going to be like you're going to be able to see a ridge you know, along the roof because you've got the ice and water shield down. And let's say you've got a three-footer that's on there right now. Well, go ahead and put a three-foot on, but then put another one-foot on top of that as well. So that sort of averages out the difference in elevation between the part of the roof that just has the felt and the ice and water shield. So if it's on there, it's doing its job, it's great, leave it on.
Leave it on. Tony in Mount Horeb, your turn. Hi, Tony.
Good morning. Regarding 120-year-old double-hung windows, I've trying to not take off the stops and parting strips to put V-seal between the two sashes. And other than that, putting like a EPDM weather strip on the bottom of the bottom sash and rope caulk between the sashes. Is it worth taking off the stops and the parting strip to get at the V-seal?
I'm sorry, I'm having trouble hearing that last word, Tony, to get at the what?
V-seal, like a little feast shaped strip that goes between the sash and the frame.
Now, okay, so these windows are 120 years old?
Good shape.
Yeah, and they do not have counterweights, or do they?
They do have counterweights.
They do have counterweights, yeah. So one of our problems with windows with counterweights is, first, you've got those ropes, which are always sort of a pain to maintain. The other thing is you've got a big hole in your wall. So you've got this box then that's about 3.5 inches by 4 inches or 4 by 4 with no insulation in it. So when I usually look at maintaining or restoring 120-year-old windows, I tend to take a look at getting rid of the weights. And basically usually they're behind the casing, so it means you have to carefully take off the casing, take out the weights. You can spray foam that with a low expansion foam, not the great stuff that blows up 30-1, but the low expansion foam. Then what I've generally have done is I put weather stripping at the, and I use the bent copper weather stripping at the bottom sash so that when you lift the sash, there's enough tension with the weather stripping that it stays up. Does that answer your question, Tony?
What was the brand name of that weather stripping?
Well, you'll find it at any hardware store. Basically, it's a piece of brass that's maybe inch or inch quarter wide, and it has usually three little ridges on it, and it is slightly hinged. So where you put the little brass nails through, and you need like a tweezer, a needle nose plier, and a very small hammer to put this on, but it can be done. But almost every hardware store has it. It comes in a roll. Just go to the weather stripping section and look for it's a sprung brass weather stripping.
Sprung brass weather stripping.
Right.
Okay.
It'd be the only brass thing you're probably going to see in the department there that comes in a roll. Everything else comes in, you know, lengths.
All right. Tony, there you go. Thank you. Eve in Madison, your turn. Hi, Eve.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you.
What's on your mind?
Okay. Well, I sit in my kitchen. It's against my garage. I'm freezing. How do I check for energy audit, and how do I add insulation?
And you've got a condo you're in, a duplex?
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay. Again, this sounds like a fairly simple one. So either a home inspector that has a thermal camera can take a look at that wall for you, or an energy inspector, but the energy inspector is going to want to do more, like the blower door test, depressurization to see where the air leaks are. Since this is a garage, you probably have drywall or something on the garage side, Eve, is that right?
That is correct.
Yes, okay.
Yes.
Well, you know, I always think that spray foam is the greatest thing in the world because of its ability to stop water vapor, stop air, and reduce thermal transmission. In a garage, it's pretty easy to just plain take drywall down and foam it and put drywall back up. But if you have any wiring or anything that you need to change in that wall, do it before you put the foam in. So I think that is probably going to be the best way to attack it. Because if your house is built before, you know, last week, Monday, I know that's going to have a lot of air leaks as well. And just putting in fiberglass insulation, which is all that's required by code, is not going to make that wall warm enough for you.
All right. There you go, Eve. Thanks very much for calling. And since it's on the garage side, you know, taking that out, what the heck? Why not?
And that has to be 5/8 inch drywall. It may have 1/2 inch now. But for the current code, it needs to be 5/8 because we need the 1-hour fire barrier there.
All right. Eve, good luck with that. Thank you for calling. Kim in Lannan will go to you now. Hi, Kim.
Hi. I have a new construction condo that is just 1 year over its warranty, just 3 months over.
Mm-hmm.
And last week I had heard a loud sound and I thought, well, maybe that's some ice falling from the roof. But then this week my son looked up at my ceiling and there's a very, very long crack across the width of the ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
I am wondering, I mean, I know that I can hire a drywaller and some painters to touch it up. I'm wondering, is that something serious enough that I should now go hire a home inspector to check out the attic?
That's a simple yes. You need to see what's going on, because if we've got a crack and we heard a bang, something has let loose, and it could have been due to thermal contraction. You maybe were given a one-year warranty, but you need to take a look at Wisconsin law by hiring an attorney, and you're going to find that almost everything has a 4-year workmanship warranty as well. So the 1 year, your warranty isn't necessarily up. But you don't take legal advice from me. Talk to an attorney, but talk to a home inspector first. Have them crawl around in the attic, figure out exactly what's going on. And if it happened in your condo, it might happen in somebody else's condo as well.
Yeah.
So if you get troubling information from the home inspector, share that with other people in the condo, because this is something where if we're happening in 3 or 4 condos and we have an issue, you may find that the builder is simply willing to come back and fix it without any arguments.
Oh, Kim, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Sharon emailed that her home has a lot of projects that need attention, but since they're all different, who should she call to get help? She doesn't want to call a different contractor for every project.
Well, Sharon didn't say where she's living, did she?
No.
Okay, yeah. Well, it is problematical, and the problem is, how do you pick the right plumber, electrician, drywaller, plasterer, glazer, whatever? It is really difficult if you have a lot of projects, especially if it's an old house. So you may have to find either a general contractor who can organize things, or they're called either construction administrators or construction coordinators. And that's what I actually did the last 20 years. I stopped being a general contractor, and I simply organized jobs for people. But I knew who the good plumbers were, the good electricians, et cetera. So I wish we knew where you were, but I think what you're going to have to do is probably check the internet for people who are in your area and see if you can find somebody who is willing to either come out and sort of do this construction administration for you, or would be willing to work as a general contractor and organize the other trades.
Makes very good sense. Ed in Northern Illinois, what's on your mind?
Hi, I wanted to check what the best way is to re-insulate to exterior ranch, because I'm going to replace the siding. So I got standard stud construction, mm-hmm, with R11 probably fiberglass. It's in good shape. And then they have cornboard over that with Tyvek and cedar lap siding. And I want to better insulate that wall when I replace the siding.
Sure. Well, if the sheathing is all in good shape because you've got a weather-resistant barrier on it, what you can do is you can do exterior insulation. And this can be done with the use of sheet foam. So basically, you can put on an inch, inch and a half, or 2 inches of a high-density foam, which should basically, I would look at doubling the insulation in the wall. If you use 2 pieces of foam and you overlap the joints, it's going to be extremely airtight. And then what I would think, if you're going to put cedar back on, Ed, what I'd like you to think of doing is to use to put strips of 3/8 plywood ripped into 1.5 inch width, attach those to the studs. So that what you're going to have is you're going to have a drywall, your vapor barrier, your insulation, your sheathing, your foam insulation. Then you're going to have the weather-resistant barrier. And remember, the foam can be a weather-resistant barrier if you tape the joints. Then you're going to have a little air space, and then you're going to put on your cedar. What's going to happen then is that your cedar is going to dry evenly. It is not going to take on moisture coming from the interior, if there is moisture coming from the interior. And basically, your cedar should go at least 25 years without even having to paint it. What you may want to do is go to the Cold Climate Housing Research Center. And the website is info, I-N-F-O, at cchrc.org. Take a look at the remote wall system.
This we can talk some more about that. We need to take a quick look. We'll come back to that, Ed, because we need to take a quick look at the news, and then we'll be back with John Freiberger, and he'll be with us till 12:30. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network, taking a look at home improvement with our regular guest, John Freiberger, Wisconsin registered home inspector. His firm, Freiberger and Associates, is based in Fitchburg. So, need help with a home improvement project? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234 or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's go to Rick in Grafton. Oh, wait a minute. Before we go to Rick in Grafton, I want to go back to Ed. I believe John, you were sort of finishing up the answer when we broke for the news.
Yes, I was suggesting that Ed take a look at the Cold Climate Housing Research Center. That's in Fairbanks, Alaska, so it's cold, right? And if you can go to their website, you can look at a whole bunch of reports. And it's www.cchrc.org/reports. Lots of interesting information. Now, some of it only works in Alaska, like the exterior vapor barrier. Don't do that in Wisconsin. It's not allowed.
Yeah.
But a lot of good pictures, a lot of good discussion, cross-sectional drawings, and some valuable information that illustrates many of the things I'm trying to tell you.
All right. Now let's go to Rick in Grafton. Rick, thanks for calling.
Hi there. I have a question for you regarding a fireplace chimney. I have a 1975 house where the fireplace hearth is actually in the basement, but it's a usable space. And about 15 years ago, I noticed some mortar was missing between some of the fire brick. So I made the mistake of inviting my dad over for an opinion. He's an old stonemason. And at age 76, he took one look at that, and the German in him came out and said, oh, no caulk on that. We're going to tear that all down. So after 2 days of tearing everything out and relaying it under his watchful eye, it was all done, and I fired it all the way he wanted it, slowly to harden everything. But as I age now, I have not used this fireplace in probably 10 or more years, and on the outside I have the stainless steel rain cap and the guarding so the animals can't crawl in. My question is, do I leave this open vented to the atmosphere, or should I put a piece of plywood or foam over the top of that? And at that time we had put a new crown wash on and inspected everything, and you could hit it with a tank and it wouldn't crack, but I'm just wondering, for longevity, how do I handle this?
Well, we're going to have some heat loss, aren't we, Rick? We're basically in the basement or the lower level of a tri-level. Is that right with this fireplace?
It's a bi-level. It's in the lower.
It's in the lower level. Yeah, it's not as bad as if it were on the floor above. But still, we're going to have a lot of heat loss because even when I assume this has a cast iron damper like most fireplaces, and that's probably pretty good. But when you seal it, you still get a lot of air leaks. A lot of people will simply make a screen, an insulated screen that sort of fits inside the opening, and cover them with wallpaper or whatever, make them look fairly attractive. And then if you decide 5 years from now you're going to use it, have everything inspected before you fire it up again. But let's try to keep interior moisture from going being sucked up that chimney by air pressure so that we don't get a whole lot of condensation that gradually causes problems to the clay tile. So I would go ahead and seal the opening at the interior.
Yeah, that would be the simple way, too, to do it, I would think. Rick, good luck with that. Thank you. Helen in New Glarus, it's your turn. Hi, Helen.
Hi. I was wondering if your guest has ever heard of using sheep's wool for insulation. I have bags of it, and I was wondering, how do you use it?
That's some really expensive insulation.
Yeah.
We do have sheepskin coats and things like that, and insulation basically is a substance that holds little bubbles of air. So sheep's wool would probably hold little bubbles of air, but remember, this is an organic product. It's not like fiberglass. What happens if it gets wet? So I think I would find another use for that sheep's wool. You're in an area with a lot of weavers and knitters and whatever. I think let's stick to the traditional insulation that we've been using in Wisconsin the last 100 years and not go back to medieval England.
There you go, Helen. Yeah, once that got wet, you'd have
it would smell.
Oh, yeah. How do sheep stand each other in the rainy season?
Exactly.
There you go. Helen, thanks. You can join in 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Susan in Janesville emailed, when looking to hire a tradesperson to perform electrical, plumbing, carpentry work, it's advisable to make sure they're licensed and insured. Could you please address how a homeowner goes about asking for this and what to look for, especially when looking at, small local companies or maybe the handyman type business?
Yeah, real important question from Susan there. We want to make sure we don't have people who are not insured, because if they get hurt in your house, they may decide it's your fault that they injured a couple and broke a couple of ribs. So you simply ask for a certificate of insurance. And the certificate of insurance does not come from Bill's Plumbing. It comes from the agency that handles the insurance for Bill's Plumbing. And it should come directly from the agency. It will tell you for what they are insured. And so it's going to have things like workman's comp and liability. Are they insured for property damage? Maybe, maybe not. There are only certain things that are required in Wisconsin for insurance. If you have a question after you get the certificate, call the insurance agent and say, exactly what does this mean? Most plumbers, electricians, etc., have their license number on their stationery and on their bills, but simply ask them for it. What is your license number? You can go to the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection, and you can check to make sure that that license actually is current. So with a quick request, maybe two follow-up calls, you can be very sure that you're getting somebody who is both licensed and insured.
Very good points. John emailed. He has a vintage house. The core was built in 1852 with additions to the present. The attics were insulated in the 40s with vermiculite, which has compressed to a solid. There are foam beds over that to fill to the top of the cavity, and the fiberglass bats over that. Does all the insulation need to be removed to upgrade, or can he add another layer of fiberglass or some other insulation over the whole thing? He's concerned about the potential carcinogenic issues with vermiculite.
Well, and John is correct. Vermiculite, most vermiculite, at least the ones that came from the mine in Montana, I guess it was, has asbestos particles in it. Now, I believe that the vermiculite trust still exists, so that money is available to remove vermiculite. So the first thing John should do, just get on the web, go to Vermiculite Trust, see what you can find, and you may then have to, I think you have to actually have a sample of it taken, which has to be an asbestos person takes a sample. They check it to make sure it's their vermiculite, and then they will pay for, I think it's 50% of the removal. But considering the age of the house, we've been talking about air leaks for an hour here, so I'm not going to repeat myself. But I would like to see everything come out in the vermiculite, the bottom layer. So that does need to go, and then you should,
you should air seal vapor barrier and insulate after that. But check for the truss, because most likely you are going to have a financial resource there that you can lean on.
Good questions and good answers there. Cheryl in Weston emailed to ask, how do you insulate walls without destroying the siding?
Well, it depends upon the type of siding you have. There are old-fashioned cedar siding is pretty easy to remove because it's nailed down at the bottom. And if it's nailed correctly, the nail only goes through one piece of siding. If you nail it too low, it catches the top of the siding that's buried beneath the bottom of the siding, and then you get a little bit of a mess. But you can remove cedar siding. You will break some of it, but you can replace it, and that will allow you to get into the walls. Other sidings, especially the ones with hidden fasteners, such as a hardy board, are a lot more difficult, but that's usually on newer houses. It's probably going to be insulated. So I would talk to the insulation contractors. They have done this 1,000 times before, and they may actually be good at it. So I would meet with one of them. They can explain how they can get through the siding and get through the weather-resistant barrier, because remember, that's got to be patched as well before the new siding goes on. And then you may have to talk to one or two, but somebody at some point is going to instill some confidence in you, and then you can go ahead with it.
All right. You can join in, get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. John wonders if you can talk about radon and radon issues and what we ought to be doing this time of the year if we're interested in checking on it.
Yeah, this time of year, I think radon is a little bit higher in the winter because we've got all this heat loss from the houses via air. So we're depressurizing our houses. And what we tend to find is the upstairs has higher air pressure than the downstairs, and that has higher air pressure than the basement. So we have a basement that actually may be pulling radon in. So the best thing to do is to do a radon test. There are a lot of firms out there that have good quality tests. They will usually do it for 48 hours, and then they'll give you an idea of what you have for radon. And then if you do have radon, you're going to have to talk to a specialist about sealing the house and putting in a radon collection system. If you've got a sump pump system, it's pretty easy. If you don't, it's a little bit more difficult. And then you want to retest after the work is done to make sure that they have gotten the picocuries per cubic deciliter of air down to an area with which you feel comfortable. And remember, America and Europe have two completely different standards. We're looking at 4, they're looking at 2.6. If I was doing it, I'd look at 2.6.
And radon itself, I mean, you don't want to be dealing with it.
Well, you certainly don't want to be living with it. Depending upon your house, you have a finished bedroom in the basement for one of the kids. Well, they may be getting exposed to a carcinogen every time they're in the bedroom. So it's a good thing to check for, and be careful when the remediation is being done.
And watch. I guess there are detectors you can buy and stick in your basement or something, too.
I think there are. I've always used a professional. Yeah. I'm just, and part of it's just the liability that I have as a consultant, that I always want somebody with a big insurance policy, because they have the little canisters that you can check, but what if they're wrong?
Yeah. you don't want that.
Right. And the problem with radon is when you're testing yourself, you're really sampling. You don't know exactly what you're going to have for radon in December and July can really be very different. So you really want a professional to look at your house.
John has a crack in his basement floor, so I think that's what maybe may have caused. I mean, it could come through a crack in the. It would come from the earth.
Yes, right. It's coming through cracks in concrete. We do in modern houses. We do have usually visqueen put underneath the floor, but of course, the guys break it when they're stomping around with their boots and raking the concrete around. If we've got a sump pump in the basement, that most likely we can get radon through the perforated pipe that's running all the way around the house and then coming in through an unsealed sump pit. So there's a lot of ways the radon can get in. And it's very variable. There are parts of Madison where you get almost no radon because it's a heavy, thick clay soil. And then you get into Shorewood where you've got limestone near the surface. And I'm surprised some of those houses don't glow in the dark.
Boy.
So it's very, very different.
Dan in La Crosse, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I have a closed-loop geothermal heating system at my house, but it was installed about 25 years ago. And I'm concerned that the radiant floor heat in my basement is not very efficient. Is there a way that I can update that system in my basement specifically?
Well, the question on your basement, Dan, is I'm assuming that you should have at least 6 inches of insulation underneath the floor. And the question is, if this was put in 25 years ago, did they insulate the floor well or did they not?
From the picture, I do have some pictures from when the house was built, and it looks like it. The one discrepancy I do see is that they're very large tubes versus, you know, the smaller tubes that are very close together that you see nowadays.
Yeah, okay. So an old-fashioned system, like, you know, there's actually some Frank Lloyd Wright houses that have that. They've actually steel pipes underneath the floor with 1- and 2-inch diameter. Yeah, that's, and I guess the question is, do you fear, Dan, that there might be a leak in the system?
I don't, but I fear that my compressor for my geothermal is working too hard to keep that basement warm enough. And I mean, I do have a gas backup, and I do have a wood stove backup, but I'm more concerned on the longevity of the compressor, the engine that keeps that geothermal working.
Well, back in the days when I was really doing that sort of stuff, we did have some old large pipe systems that basically we fed modern piping through, which is flexible. And then what you do if the system is tight and not leaking is you can put in a transfer, you know, medium, a liquid medium, so that the small diameter pipes heat the medium, which then heats the floor. Now, you're going to have to talk to somebody who's done a lot of geothermal to be able to retrofit that. But depending upon, well, you're in La Crosse. I think there's a couple of people over there that know geothermal. So I would make a couple of calls and then consult with them, because we can get the same number of BTUs delivered to the floor with a lot less flow and a lot less compression.
Dan, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Margie in Milwaukee, you have a question. Hi.
Hi. I'm not sure if you can help me, but I recently moved out of an apartment complex. It was a 55-plus community. I was arguing with management for over 2 months about mold in my HVAC closet, where the water drainage tube was clogged and water overflowed, and I had 2 feet, 3 feet of mold all the way around all 3 walls, and it spread into the baseboards in my bedroom and in under the tack strips for the carpet, and they kept doing simple things. They did a spray, and I said that wasn't good enough. They wouldn't move the duct, and I could tell there was mold behind the ductwork, so I finally called a outside company to come in and test my apartment, and they found 3 different kinds of mold, yellow, black, and green, and they said there were mold spores in the air, and they gave a list of 11 things that they had to do according to federal law to pull out the furnace, and they had to cut out the drywall and blah, blah, blah. So I moved out, and I want to hold them accountable for my costs, and also I've talked to 6 other people that live in there that over the years, they have been just doing this patchwork stuff where they spray stuff and they say, oh, I know it's still black, but we killed it. It's dead.
Yeah.
And I know it's not right. And I've seen their HVACs and their water tubes are clogged and discolored. And what can I do to, I mean, how do I find somebody? I've already talked to 3 law firms that say they don't know anything about mold. Is there an agency or something that I can get some direction?
Unfortunately, no. I have faced this problem again and again, 2 or 3 times a year, because the condo, the HVAC systems they put into condos are just, well, they want to sell condos cheap, and a lot of them are not very well put together. An attorney doesn't need to know anything about mold. They only have to know about the law. So I'm a little surprised that you got that reaction from them. I would call a couple of other attorneys because there's a possibility actually of a class action suit here. And what is, you're going to have to talk to the old management board for the condo association. I'm assuming there's an owner's association. And this is going to be expensive. So if you hire an attorney, you'll realize that it's not real easy to necessarily get your costs refunded. So I think you're going to have to just call attorneys until you find one that will talk to you, and they may say, you're out of there, just leave it at rest, because the courts are slow, the courts are expensive. Law is very expensive.
Margie, thank you very much for calling. Bruce, in email to ask, what's the difference between a water softener and a water conditioner?
Oh, good question. I don't know.
I'm not sure either.
Yeah, I don't know either. Let's Google them both and read. I know exactly what a water softener does, but a conditioner could be doing all kinds of things. And there are various filter systems. There's filters for people who have iron and other things. So exactly what water sins a conditioner conditions out, I don't know.
Bob in Richland Center, do you have a quick question?
Yeah, a real quick one. So earlier in the program, you talked about stone basements and not using the rubberization. Is there some site I can look at to see what I should do or could do? I know we have to fix the mortar, but then now they're insulating. What do we do from that so it doesn't cause damage?
Email me. So I gave it out earlier. It's FREI at chorus. .net, chorus like a group of singers, CHORUS. Send me a couple of photos and let's talk by email, because stone situations, I've seen all different types, but to have you try to describe it on the air and for me to answer you take about 5 minutes. So let's do email.
All right, there you go, Bob. Thank you so much. And John, thank you so much. Gosh, it's always a pleasure.
It is a pleasure. A lot of good questions today. Some questions of public interest, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, full disclosure, mentioning that Freiberger Consulting is one of Wisconsin's public radio's many business sponsors, and we appreciate that as well. John Freiberger of Freiberger and Associates of Fitchburg, he comes by every couple months, and we'll do this all over again with him probably in 2 months.
That sounds good, Larry.
Thanks, John. Looking ahead to tomorrow, oh my goodness, it's Friday, and that means Garden Talk. And Joel Karsten is back to talk about straw bale gardening and take your questions. That's tomorrow at 11 and 6 on Saturday morning. And by the way, the Garden Expo is on this weekend, and at 9:30 on Saturday, I'll be there with Lisa Johnson, and we'll talk some more with you, maybe in person. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller.